and welcome to the ninth episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. And joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO Confluence. We're recording this podcast on April 14th. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate question and answer sessions Mark and I have participated in for the past 25 years. If you'd like to submit a question, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we'll select four or five of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive, Mark and I will address them. So without further ado, let's tackle the first one. I was curious what Confluence's take is with Iran recently coming out and only accepting yuan instead of dollars, breaking a 25-year deal. What kind of ramifications do you guys think this could cause? Well, I'll start there. It's important to note that Iran has been frozen out of the U.S. dollar system. So it's sanctioned in such a fashion that if it gets dollars, it can't do anything with them. So it makes virtually no sense for them to transact in U.S. dollars. Since China is a large trading partner for Iran, and it also runs a trade deficit with the People's Republic, accumulating yuan to balance their deficit makes a lot of sense. Now, the question does bring up some broader issues. For most of this century, the U.S. has been weaponizing the U.S. dollar system, which makes the dollar and treasuries less attractive for reserve purposes. The freezing of Iran's assets played a role in that. The freezing of Russia's assets after they invaded Ukraine was an extreme wake-up call, and one of the reasons gold prices moved up as much as they did was a perception that central banks and monetary authorities and reserve managers needed to diversify their reserve holdings, because the dollar treasury system, if you got caught crossways with Washington, could be bad for you. And so there's been a lot of talk, a lot of hand-wringing about the end of the U.S. dollar system, the end of, you know, the dollar's reserve status. But I think it's really important to note that the other alternatives to the dollar treasury system are just not robust. The euro would be probably the strongest competitor from a currency perspective. The problem is that there's no genuine reserve asset. You have to pick the sovereign debt of one of the countries. Germany probably pretty safe. Portugal, maybe not so much. China has a closed capital account, so they'd be happy for you to hold yuan, but they're not going to let you put money in with the freedom to take it out. The other currencies are frankly too small. So the alternative, there is an alternative to using gold, but gold's clunky. It's not easy to borrow against. So the dollar is going to remain the reserve currency, even if it becomes less popular. And oh, there's all kinds of possibilities that could emerge. We could end up with regional currency systems where if you trade within the bloc, you use the currencies of your neighbors. And if you get outside of it, you use dollars or gold or something else. The other thing you often see on CNBC and other financial media is analysts hand-wringing about the end of the dollar reserve system. One of the truisms of economics is that there are no universally good or bad outcomes. You could make the argument that all economists are Buddhists at heart. Now, for the financial system, loss of the dollar reserve system would be an unalloyed bad because we have an enormous American financial system, mostly because of our reserve status. We have to create products for foreigners to own, and we have to create pipelines for those dollars to flow back into the United States and get invested. So the end of that reserve status would leave us with a financial system that's probably too big for purpose. On the other hand, industry, commodity producers would benefit greatly by the end of the dollar-based system. One of the sort of fun things I like to do, and gives you an idea of what a nerd I am, I suppose. But if you look at the Big Mac Index, which The Economist magazine does, where it compares the prices of Big Macs across economies, the exception of a handful of countries, the dollar's overvalued. Those other currencies are undervalued. And for that reason, the U.S. financial system benefits from that overvaluation. A lot of other parts of the economy do not. So one factor, if as the dollar becomes less potent or less robust as a global currency, probably the big fallout is globalization becomes a lot less attractive as a system. So I said a lot there.
I just want to underscore something you said. You know, there's not a universal good or bad to these things. They usually just kind of muddle along when things start to change. And people tend to misunderstand what it means to be a reserve currency. You know, it's like maybe the privilege it's given to the biggest, strongest country and all that stuff. But it's more than that. To be a reserve currency, the currency has to be actually something that other people want both to use for trade as well as, you know, other people need to want to receive that in exchange. Plus, there needs to be things to buy if you decide just to hold it. No one wants to just hold cash. They want to invest it. And there's just not many alternatives right now. And yeah, it is, the U.S. is a less popular hegemon right now, but there's just not any good alternatives at the moment. Maybe they'll evolve over the next decade or two or three, but it's not obvious to me.
Luke Groman, who's a financial writer and a popular podcast participant, puts it pretty bluntly. He said you can have a reserve currency or you can have industrialization, but you can't have both. And the reason that's the case is that the U.S. has been open to financial flows. Ben Bernanke wrote a paper early in the turn of the century arguing that foreigners were purposely oversaving and then dumping that saving on the U.S. And that's typically not the narrative that you hear. The narrative that you usually hear is that, oh, we're profligate spenders, and boy, if foreigners decide not to send our dollars here, man, we're really hosed. And sometimes that's the case, but the reality most of the time is we're absorbing the world's excess saving, and it's keeping their unemployment down, and frankly, our unemployment higher. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that if you look at employment growth in the U.S., it's primarily in service sectors that can't be exported away or imported away. And that's why we didn't have healthcare job growth. We'd have no job growth at all. So,
yeah, it's an interesting observation, reserve currency versus industrialization. Obviously, the country receives good from either of those directions. The problem is different sectors and different people in the economy benefit from them differently. And that kind of explains the political landscape we have right now.
Very much so. Second question. We're receiving questions out here in the field about, is there a looming private credit bubble? And if we are, what happens? Now, I'm going to let you lead this one off. What do you think?
If I had a nickel for every time this question has come up. I'm sitting watching I'm at the hockey game last night watching our recently demoted Blues. I say demoted because they are not going to make the playoffs. And my phone buzzes, and there's a question from a good friend of mine who's an executive at a brokerage firm asking me this very same question. And it was probably the sixth or seventh time that day I got it. It's just, it's following me around like a dog that wants...
Nothing like smartphones, huh?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. First,
I know you want to go back to pagers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's the first off. It's really, really unusual to have a bubble in debt securities. Okay, that's usually what you get is a bubble in the equity that those debt securities are supporting. And it could be the housing bubble of about 20 years ago. And of course, the debt securities get hit. So to speak properly about it, there may be a bubble that has been building for a long time in private equity that private credit is supporting. So if those valuations in private equity or in performance, and I don't know that it is a true bubble in private equities, you know, I call it a boom, which is different. In my terminology is a little different. But yes, private credit would get hurt if private equity has a serious downturn. The issue that I come across, though, and it's a huge market, by the way, private credit. It's estimated to be $2 trillion. I don't know. I mean, it's private. We really don't know. But it's big. Okay. And you say, oh, gosh, anything bad that happens in that is going to be bad for the economy. Well, bad for the investors. Whether it's bad for the economy is determined by whether there's a systemic risk.
Right.
Is this the kind of thing that can ripple through the financial system? Well, it does if the banking system primarily is on the hook. And by and large, the banking system isn't. You know, the Secretary of the Treasury, Bessent, just called in all these big bank heads recently and asked them what their exposure is. And Bloomberg's carrying a story this morning that it's about $100 billion. Actually, that's about a third of what I thought it was. I had seen some scuttlebutt in the industry that it was about $300 billion had been lent to private credit to support their credit, usually on a secured basis. And at that level, it would sting, but it wouldn't take down the banking industry, wouldn't cause the kind of ripples and domino falls that the mortgage crisis did, you know, 20 years ago. If it's only $100 billion, honestly, that's something that's not too bad for the system.
It's not that big.
Sounds big, isn't big. And by the way, the banking industry, when it lends to private credit managers, is doing so almost entirely on a secured basis. And these are mark-to-market secured basis, which means you don't have to have a default for the bank to want their money back. All you have to do is for the value to drop. In that sense, it's kind of like a margin loan on stock portfolio. And it's called, these secured arrangements are usually callable in 24 hours. So it's very much like a margin loan, which is actually a pretty safe form of lending. So I just don't see the banking system at risk. So who is at risk if this goes down? Well, the investors in the private credit themselves, which are overwhelmingly pension funds, foundations, et cetera. And that would hurt those. I mean, the value of those pensions would drop, the value of those foundation earnings, up college, you know, endowments, all that kind of stuff. In other words, the big institutions in the U.S. markets, they would take a hit. But because those institutions don't borrow money from banks to buy this stuff, they get hit, but it doesn't have a second order effect. So it would be really bad, and it would be bad, you know, if you are invested in your pension fund is invested, or et cetera, it could reduce the value of your holdings, just like a bear market in stocks would. But you don't necessarily get a run on the bank kind of phenomena. And at this point in time, I haven't been able to connect the dots to see a run on the bank.
People in financial markets tend to be like generals. They fight the last war. So when you bring up the idea of a financial problem, everybody immediately gravitates to the great financial crisis because it's the last one we've had. That makes sense. The difference between private credit and bank lending is in the funding. Private credit funding comes from equity. And those equity holders could get stiffed, be bad for them, but about the only systemic risk you would have is that lending overall would fall. Now, banks have been excluded from a lot of lending since the great financial crisis. It's possible banks would end up filling that void. Frankly, I'd be more worried about that in the long run than what we'd be going through. But what makes bank lending dangerous is the funding is coming, at least not a good portion of it, is coming from deposits, and deposits are runnable. Back in the 30s, there was a proposal out of the University of Chicago that deposit making, we would have a part of the banking system that would just take retail deposits, and it would only invest in treasuries. It's called the Chicago system. The commercial banks fought it and sort of won, although we've kind of actually created that system with the money market system, which tends to pay higher yields and is generally safer. And then what private credit has done is created the other leg of the Chicago system, which is have merchant banks that would be funded primarily by equity and lend out of equity. So banks are getting squeezed on both directions here, and it doesn't mean that they don't have a function. They clearly still lend, but you know, a lot of it's mortgages, a lot of it's credit cards. They still do commercial lending, but private credit has taken a big share of that. I personally think it's a superior model. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they won't have credit cycles. They're human beings. They put their pants on one leg at a time, despite everything you hear about how superior they are in their credit analysis. And until you have a credit cycle, you just don't know. But my suspicion is that it's a dampener on the economy, but it does not create conditions like we saw in 2008.
Yeah, you're hearing a lot about it right now because there have been some investors in these things, almost entirely retail, who have tried to run, they kind of thought, maybe they thought they had a deposit type of thing. And they've tried to get their money back, but these things, you know, are illiquid, and you can only get your money out usually once a quarter, and they can limit how much. Yes. And so by and large, it hasn't been a run from the institutional community, who I think understood it. But a lot of the non-listed, non-traded private credit funds were sold retail just over the last 5-6 years. And, you know, that kind of illiquidity doesn't sit well with most retail investors. No, they kind of want their money when they want it. It's been a bad match. I would say, you know, the publicly traded BDCs are a better choice for retail investors because you can sell them and get your money out.
That's
You know, the valuations may decline just like with any stock, but you can get your money out. But these, ever since the non-traded BDCs started to become popular several years ago, I kind of figured next credit cycle, this is going to happen.
So kind of the bottom line here is that it's a potential problem. It's probably not one that's going to be as significant as the worries are.
It's always easy as a commentator or a strategist to forecast an apocalypse. It's very easy to do, and you get a lot of listeners. It's really unpopular to say, yeah, there's a problem there, but I don't think it's going to be as bad as you think. That doesn't sell a lot of newspapers.
Well, you're always
newspapers.
You're always suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, who's paying him?
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that's kind of the way I see it at the moment.
Third question, and obviously this one was a gimme. What are the ramifications of the Iran war? What should we be looking for in the aftermath? You know, our position here at Confluence, really since we started the firm in 2007, has been that the U.S. would either abandon or significantly alter its hegemonic activities. Although the current administration will be blamed for much of the change, in reality, the hegemonic role has been evolving since President Obama. Now evident, the U.S. can no longer guarantee open global shipping. I mean, Iran's a third-rate power. If they can close a critical choke point like this, imagine what the PLA Navy could do to the Far East. Free and open ocean transit was a major pillar of American globalization, and now that's in question. This change should hasten regionalization of the global economy. Shorter shipping lanes are easier to defend and to negotiate. The other thing it leads to is redundancies. You know, we've spent 40 years treating inventory as a bad thing and, you know, something that you shouldn't do. It's important to note, just-in-time inventory logistics are a function of having a hedgeman that keeps the sea lanes open. And it's becoming pretty evident that there's going to be sea lanes that can be contested. The U.S. Navy may not be capable anymore of keeping them open. And it isn't necessarily, I mean, look, the fleet's gotten smaller, but the big change is drone technology. Mm-hmm. That's the new thing. We always knew Iran could close this strait, but our expectation was either they try to do it with the Navy or with mines. And the Navy wasn't going to be able to compete with U.S. Navy. And mining, you know, it's sort of like shooting off your own foot because, yeah, you're blocking everyone else, but you're blocking yourself too. Mines don't discriminate. But drones actually do. And they're easy to launch. They're cheap to make. You raise threats. And clearly it's done a number on Gulf shipping. And to me, that's the longer-term ramification. We still are staring down the potential of a real problem. If this strait doesn't get open in the next 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to start to see not just higher prices, but you can't get stuff. I was listening to a podcast guy that from Bloomberg that covers petrochemicals, and he was making the argument, and it was on a couple weeks ago, probably in another 2 or 3 weeks, grocers are going to start running out of plastic sheeting, you know, to protect food. The meat case could look really weird. You know, we'd have to go back to butcher paper, or you just have to go back to the butcher and get your cuts fresh. It's a whole different world without plastics.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turns out this was a really critical waterway, and now it's disruptible. And so what will happen after that? Well, lessons are learned. Yeah, they'll reopen it at some point. But no one's going to trust it. I expect that pipelines will be built across the Arabian Peninsula to the Mediterranean and to the Indian Ocean. Payoffs will be made, whatever it takes to get this stuff out of there and diversify the shipment pattern. All that costs money.
Mm-hmm.
in an ideal world, in an efficient world, you wouldn't do that. But what we find out, what COVID pointed to us and what this points to us, is that there are costs to efficiencies. You have to be willing to live with shortages. Otherwise, if you don't want the shortages, you got to pay up for inventory and you got to pay up for alternative supply routes.
Mm-hmm. There's two reasons to hold inventory. One is you think it's going to be more expensive tomorrow, so you might as well buy it today.
Yep.
And the other reason is you're concerned you can't get it tomorrow at all. And so you got to stack up. You know, we observe this, you stand and watch a grocery store and 48 hours before a snowstorm comes in, you know.
Yep.
This is that kind of a snowstorm for the world. And people are not going to forget it. And I'm not talking about people who are buying 5 gallons of milk before storm, but you know, business planners have not had to worry about this stuff. You know, if inflation is low and it's easy to get anything, it's kind of silly to tie up capital and lots of inventory. But when those things change, now you need to hold inventory. And I just think that anyone who thinks we're going back to the old way of thinking is going to be disappointed, because I think business planners now are in a completely different mindset. Their bosses, their CEOs are going to want to know how long, if something bad happens again, how long can we keep the factory running before we run out of stuff? It, you know, many factories couldn't run more than a week to maybe even a couple of days if the inventory didn't arrive just in time. We may, you know, back when you and I got in the business, it was a long time ago, but, you know, most factories had enough inventory of raw material and or parts to operate maybe as long as a month. And it didn't hurt financially because that inventory was not depreciated. Right. It may actually be appreciating while it's sitting, you know, in the tank or in the bin. And that's kind of where we're going back to. I feel pretty confident.
Early in my career, I worked in retailing, and we were taught fill the stores to the gills because that inventory rose faster in price than the interest cost to carry it. Now, that all reversed after Volcker, but that was one of the factors that boosted inflation in the 70s. The other interesting thing you touch on is that there are a number of industrial processes. Oil refining is one, plastics is one, chip making, semiconductor production is another, that if you have to shut these facilities down, it can take months to restart them, weeks to months. I mean, oil refineries shutting down. I remember when I used to cover oil really closely and we'd have a hurricane in the Gulf, you know, you'd have to shut these refineries down. The restarts were always dicey. You know, stuff blows up, somebody drops a wrench, and next thing you know, you're out of business for two or three months. So they loathe to cut the production down. So what a lot of them are doing in the Far East now is refinery runs are dropping so they can keep the thing going and stretch out their dwindling oil supplies so they don't have to pull the plug on the place. We're getting close to the point where we're not going to be able to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, once you go through an experience like this, I mean, this is one of the things that scarred those of us who grew up in the 70s, is that, you know, you see pictures of gas lines and you think, oh man, that really sucks. Boy, gasoline prices are really high. That wasn't what scared you. What scared you was you could get it. Mm-hmm. You sit in line for hours and you get to your place at the pump and they'd be like, ah, sorry, champ, we're all out. I mean, it that's what spooks you. That's when, you know, you would see people stock up their houses with canned goods and frozen meats and stuff. It's the same thing. And
it killed the large car industry in the U.S. You know, a 10 mile per gallon car, which was common. You know, my father traveled for a living as a salesman, and, you know, he was a tall guy. He was 6'3", and he needed a large car. But when oil prices, or gasoline prices, well, first they quadrupled, yep, early 70s, and then they, you know, tripled again later. You know, he had to buy a small car. It was very uncomfortable for him, but to try to get something with a MPG so he could actually make a living. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And everyone was, you could put money down on a small Honda vehicle, let's say Honda Accord, which was one of the popular ones, which was much smaller than modern Accords. And you might wait 6 to 12 months for to come in, because everybody wanted one.
Yeah. And
for sound economic reasons,
everybody wanted one. Lots of big cars on the lots.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when you were to trade your big car, they wouldn't give you jack
nothing,
for it.
Nothing, no. Things change. So I'm telling folks, when you're looking at the Iran situation, don't listen to, you know, tweets from the president or something that, you know, other people are saying about, or even what Iran's saying. You know, don't just watch the Strait of Hormuz.
Yep.
That is the economic choke point. If it's closed, regardless of what anyone says, we're going to have economic problems. If it opens back up, things get better, but memories will linger.
Well, and kind of wrap it up with this point, even big cars today get pretty decent mileage.
Yes.
Compared to big cars in the 70s. And, you know, we've created hybridization, we've make them a lot more efficient. That's all memory from that period. Last question. One of the asset allocation themes recently was called the Great Rotation. Do you think that still holds? What do you think?
The answer is yes.
Okay. Well, very good. We'll wrap it up here then.
we've seen some rather dramatic changes in the markets. Oh, really, since late October, early November of last year. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Valuations don't turn markets, but they do get to extremes sometimes where you think, boy, there's not a lot to be gained here by going long that area. And I think a lot of folks were kind of thinking that way. It turns out that one of the catalysts was worry that AI, which everyone has been so excited about, might do net more damage to the technology sector than it benefits them. And up to that point, you know, the IT sector of the market, which, you know, was it 15%, 20%, 25%, 35%, 40% of the market, all of a sudden are saying, not everybody may benefit over there. And together with other world events, geopolitical events, has been making investors start to think, you know, people who make stuff, while may not be as exciting as people who make software and things I can't really touch, you know, we still need stuff. And right. AI may actually make it more efficient to make stuff. And that has, I think, in a nutshell, is one of the reasons we started to see things begin to change. There are other reasons, I think. But, you know, year to date, IT tech growth stocks are down. They're one of the few. A lot of folks say, oh, the market's down. Well, actually, almost every other part of the market is up, even with the things going on in the world. So we have been almost 6 months now with this rotation, and it looks pretty powerful. I think we're finally seeing it happen.
It's pretty interesting to look at what's like happened to the software stocks, who were kind of the princelings of asset light, you know, just throwing off all kinds of free cash flow, and how could you go wrong? They don't invest in anything, and there was some obviously occasionally basic concerns about what they pay people. But boy, AI has just been a torpedo under the waterline for that group. I mean, it's getting to the point now where they're starting to look so cheap that you're like, huh? But you look at the chart, and it's like Daddy always told me, don't try to grab a falling knife, and I tried to prove him wrong on several occasions, and turned out, he's probably right on that one. But that's what the chart looks like. Looks bad.
They're cheap relative to sales and earnings, but those sales and earnings may be overstated. We're sailing into, you know, brave new world here, where maybe you don't need buildings full of programmers to write software to make your business work, or just to fill out a decent spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Your little bit of money you spend on AI may allow you to build that spreadsheet, build that simple program to run your business, et cetera. Yeah, it's I think, too soon to decide, hey, yeah, these are cheap. But meanwhile, as I said, people are starting to look at other stuff, and AI may enhance that. The fact is, we still need steel. We still need bricks. We still need things. Food, which, you know, food stocks, no one wants them right now anyway. But you still need stuff and gasoline, as we were just talking about. And AI doesn't replace these things. It actually may enhance the profitability of the companies that make this stuff. And I think this is starting to dawn on investors, and they look around at these stuff-making companies, and they say, yeah, you know, they're not that expensive. We forgot about those.
Yes, that's right. The only thing I would add to any of that, if we're right about regionalization. Globalization is probably going to fracture into regionalization. Smaller capitalization equities actually tend to benefit in those. I remember when I used to travel through Michigan and Indiana, there was a whole series of small firms that fed into the U.S. automobile production system. And those all got moved overseas. You could easily see a situation where those start to come back. So I think the reversal of globalization, if we've practiced it since the 1980s, but especially after 1990, probably is going to be good for the smaller capitalization sector in the market as well.
Yeah.
It's a little early yet. There's some signs of it, but
I agree. I think it is real, and it's in one sense it's kind of like the AI trade versus everything else. But it's also what are the AI stocks? Well, they're mega cap stocks, so it's kind of the very large capitalization stocks versus
everybody smaller, else.
Everybody else. It's also the growth stocks versus the value stocks. There's this rotation is kind of getting into everything. And in fact, we're even, you know, one of the forgotten sectors is foreign stocks.
Yeah.
And, you know, been pretty much a dead group from a U.S. investor's point of view for a dozen years. And they have been perking up. So I think it's, in the long run, it's a healthy trend for the market. A very narrow market, which was what was happening, is actually an unhealthy market in the long run. It can get very, not a narrow breadth can lead to more problems. So I'm kind of pleased to see this develop, but it's not going to be a straight line because a lot of these companies in the AI trade are actually really outstanding businesses. They just got overextended. It'll be a sawtooth line as they readjust to, I think, more reasonable valuations. But it's I think in the long run healthy for the market.
Well, Mark, I think that's a pretty good place to close today. Again, as a reminder, if you want to submit a question, send one to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.